Well, good morning again. I guess I'm pulling a little bit of double duty. When I was first asked to introduce our speaker today, I was incredibly honored, incredibly humbled. I haven't gotten to know him extremely well, but what I have known, he's been a great friend, tried and true, and has done some great things for me. I first got to know our speaker last summer when we went out with a few people to Kansas City to the National Worship Leaders Conference. He was there kind of speaking about Asbury, specifically about a new worship arts program. It was my first real glimpse into his life and his witness. And it was just incredible to watch how he spoke to the prospective students or adults or just random passerbys who would walk by our booth. He spoke with such energy. He spoke with such passion and with such truth. And you could just see like his passion for this place and for every one of you in the way that he was talking, in the way that he was speaking to these people. So we came back to school, and October came around. And October happens to be one of my favorite months because it happens to be when the Major League Baseball playoffs take place. And it just so happens that this year, my team, the Yankees, happened to go to the World Series. I've been a fan since I was 7, so don't hold it against me. It was my next-door neighbor's fault. He was from New York, so... So I found out that Dr. Kalaga and his family just happened to be taking a trip to New York City during the World Series. Not even like game one, like game five, game six, that sort of time frame. I think he said specifically that it was maybe the first time ever he'd rooted for the Yankees. But it really didn't matter to me because I was like, I've gotten to know him a little bit. I'm pretty outspoken. I'm going to ask him to get me a World Series t-shirt. So I did, and I gave him some money, and he did. He brought me back an incredible t-shirt. And he's just a really incredible guy because one of my favorite things that he actually brought back was some actual confetti from the World Series parade. Picked it up off the street for me. So I really appreciated that. It was a big deal. I still keep it. I still have it, and I always will keep it. That's number 27, you know, number 28 next year. I don't know. We'll see. But to leave you, Dr. Kalaga has many nicknames. I don't know if he knows about them. I've never actually said them to him. I'm going to blame Caitlin Ovenshine because she's not here anymore. But some of the favorites are DJ Cool, Dr. John Kalaga, DJ Cool. My personal favorite is Dr. K-Log. But he's got many nicknames. But you guys know him as Dr. Kalaga. He's our provost, and he's a great guy. So would you listen to him as he comes and speaks to us today?
Thanks, McKenzie. I appreciate that. I'm the last of the big-time spenders, as you can tell, scraping scrap paper off the street. It's interesting, actually, we went down. I was trying to avoid. I'm not a Yankees fan. My favorite team is actually anybody who plays the Yankees and anybody who plays Notre Dame. Those are my two favorite teams. So we were trying to avoid, my luck, you know, we're flying to New York City, my wife and daughter and I, and it's the first time I've ever been to New York City. We're actually flying over New York Stadium, Yankee Stadium, Game 6. The blimp was there, and we saw everything, and they won. So I knew that while I was there, I was going to have to endure not only New York City for the first time, but a parade. And we did everything we could to avoid the parade, and we got down to the south side of Manhattan to take the Staten Island Ferry, again, because I'm such a big spender. The Staten Island Ferry, if you don't know, is free. And it goes to Staten Island and back, and actually goes within about a quarter mile of the Statue of Liberty. So you can see the Statue of Liberty for free. You don't have to pay for any of those other extra ferry costs. So we took the subway down there and got to Staten Island and went to come back. And we were kicked off the boat, the Staten Island ferry boat, to come back to Manhattan because of a police action that was occurring in Manhattan at the time. Now, we had just come there 30 minutes ago. From there. And so they kicked us off. We waited around for 45 minutes, and they finally let us back on. It was indefinitely suspended. Ferry service is indefinitely suspended. You know, I'm first time there. I have no map. My idea was to get on the ferry, see the statue, walk around to the other ferry, and come back and hit the road. When we got back onto Manhattan, the place was crawling with New York's finest. I mean, in riot gear, the rifles. There was like 200 of them in the station. Because of the New York City parade, fans had gotten a little rowdy, a little out of hand. Some had been imbibing something, outside the community standards. And it was only about 11 a.m. in the morning, but the least I could do was pick up some scrap paper. And some of you may have noticed as you walked in, there was some smoke. I want to, first of all, thank you. My topic will hopefully make sense as we go along. I want to talk today about two things. I want to talk to you mainly about being a sent one, mainly about not just merely going, but really being a sense of calling, a sense of being sent. But I also wanted to play on words today and talk about how you go. It's just as important as going itself, and that you carry with you the aroma of Christ. And so I wanted to accentuate that today as you walked in, and I want to thank Father Patterson at St. Athanasius Orthodox Church for the donation of the frankincense that you walked through this morning when you came. Many of you read about frankincense and myrrh at Christmas time, but you've not really experienced it. And so I wanted you to feel that. I wanted you to smell that. I wanted it to get on your clothing today. Hopefully, as you walk out of here today, you'll smell that. And I also want to thank Bert Walther and Rick Cook and IS because they're the ones who got it for us. And I don't know the first thing about burning incense. When I was a kid, you kind of got it at some stores, and it was a little cone-shaped thing, and it was illegal. You weren't allowed to burn it in the residence hall, so I want to thank them for doing that. I want to start off with a little context, if you will. So we're going to strap in. Hopefully in the next 15, 20 minutes I can go through everything. I always plan about 90 minutes when I'm given 20, so hopefully we can get through all this. In it, not of it, the statement was made as Christian One faced the world much afraid. In it, not of it, the call was made clear. But Christian One got something stuck in his ear. Not in it or of it was the thing that he heard. And knowing the world was painfully absurd, he welcomed the safety of a pious retreat and went to church potlucks for something to eat. Now, Christian Two, he knew what to do. He'd show those fundies a thing or two. How will the world ever give Christ a try if we don't get in there and identify? So in it and of it, he said in his car as he pulled in to try out the latest rave bar. I'll tell them the truth as soon as I'm able to get myself out from under this table. Now along comes Christian Three jogging for Jesus in witnessing sweats all Under Armour pieces. Her iPhone is playing a new Christian tune about how the Lord is coming back soon. Not in it, but of it. She turns down the hill and stops in for a latte at the Agape Grill. Like the gold on the chain of her Save the Earth bracelet, she can have all the world without having to face it. While way up in heaven, they lament these conditions that come from changing a few prepositions. Not in or of it, Christian One thought, but who in the world will know that he's not? In it and of it, thought Christian Two, but who in the world will know that he knew? Not in it, but of it, thought Christian Three, but who in the world watches Christian TV? And Jesus turns to Gabriel, shaking his head. In it, not of it. Isn't that what I said? We live in a culture of smells. We have coffee, one of my favorite smells, French vanilla and hazelnut. Candles. This became acutely aware to me over Christmas break as I was shopping and I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about. There are so many things that have smells. You can't even sanitize your hands now without a smell. You know, cucumber melon. You know, I just want the germs off my hands. Hand sanitizer. You go into the Bath and Body Shop and it's all about smells, isn't it? Perfume and cologne, of course, that's a natural. But now there's a lotion that has aromatherapy. I thought that was real interesting. Peppermint combats mental fatigue, and rosemary promotes creative thinking. See, I always thought it was a good night's rest and study. But now you can forget all that. Just get some lotion, slap it on before a test, and you're ready to go. I'm so thankful that we've come so far. Isaiah chapter 6 talks about Isaiah, and he sees the Lord high and lifted up. And God is speaking from his throne, and he says, who shall I send? We get the wrong impression sometimes from that verse that Isaiah was called at that moment. And in reality, Isaiah wasn't really called. He didn't the Lord didn't say, Isaiah, will you go? He just said, who shall we go? It was a generic call. And Isaiah happened to overhear it. The question was generic, who shall I send? The question was not directed to Isaiah. Isaiah overheard the question. Again, the next question is, who shall I go? Who will go for us? So God, the Trinity is talking to one another. Who will go for us? Isaiah did not decide where to go. If you read chapter 6, it goes on to say, go to this people. He didn't get to decide even his mission, because the next part of the verse says, go to this people and tell them this. He didn't even get to decide the length of his mission. God said, Isaiah says, well, how long? And God says, until the cities are devastated and the land is desolate. I want to talk to you about being sent into the culture. 2-minute Old Testament lesson. There were two roads back in ancient times. If you looked over off to the this section off to the east, or you had Babylon, Mesopotamia. Down here in the lower area, you had Egypt. There was basically two ways to get for those two great kingdoms to trade with one another. You could take the King's Highway down over here and then over, or you could take what was called the Via Maris down this way. It's called the Way of the Sea. Down the middle of this section of the Promised Land is all mountains. And at the top right about here is Jerusalem. When the Bible talks about going up to Jerusalem, it's literally talking about going up to Jerusalem. It's not a metaphor like we're going to go up to Lexington. That's north. You literally went up to Jerusalem. But because of that, it was a treacherous way and it was hard to travel. So you'd go by the way of the Via Maris, by the way of the sea, or by the King's Highway. There was basically one route that would connect these two called the Jericho Trade Route from Gezer to Gibeon to Jericho, then across and then into the King's Highway. So you can imagine this is the way that Egypt would trade with Babylon, and this was the shortcut route if you wanted to come down and come over. There was one city that was strategic to all of that, and that was Gezer, right here. Gezer literally stood at the crossroads of cultural influence. Ancient Gezer, you refer to it as Old Gezer. But Gezer stood at the crossroads of cultural influence. All of the economic, political, cultural trade that was taking place back then. Sometimes I used to think of this area when you study the Old Testament, you think of it as maybe in the context like Northwest Iowa, all right, or Southwest Nebraska. Has anybody been to those regions? It's not real bustling. It's not a real happening place. It's a great place to be from. But that's not what this was going on. This was the cultural center. This was the crossroads of culture. And God had given his people that particular area to land, to control. And as they did that, they controlled the culture. They would interact with Mesopotamia and Babylon. They'd interact with Egypt. And the Hebrew way of doing economics and doing politics and how they treated people, their religion, their faith would be transmitted to the different peoples that they'd come in contact with. The Israelites had a tendency, though, to abdicate in a couple ways this responsibility. One is that they would head up into the hill country. Because that was such a vital part, that was a very, the Pharaoh had invaded it once. Ephraim had come in and taken the people over and made them forced slaves. So the Israelites reacted in two ways. One is that they would head to the hill countries and they'd abdicate that role. They lived in isolation and they let the Canaanites have the town. They turned the cultural influence over to somebody else. Or two, they would live with the Canaanites and become just like them, and you couldn't tell them apart. So either they lived in isolation or they would live in assimilation, and you couldn't tell the difference apart. But either way, they lost their ability to control the culture of their time. And the test of any vitality of any religion is to be seen in the effect it has upon the culture. Jesus comes along many years later and notices the same thing with the Pharisees. He would go into the marketplace, and the Pharisees' idea of being clean was to avoid anybody who might make them unclean. Their idea of holiness was to be away from and to stay away from anything that might make them unclean. And so you had the ethic of avoidance with the Pharisees. Don't touch this person, don't touch that person, don't eat that food, wash several times. Holiness by isolation, holiness by avoidance. Jesus comes along and has an ethic of involvement. Who does he touch? Who does he reach out to? Lepers, the blind, the tax collectors, the prostitutes. The very people that the Pharisees were staying away from were the very people that Jesus engaged. And cultural influence abhors a vacuum. Somebody will influence the culture. It's kind of like doctrine. Doctrine abhors a vacuum. You will believe something. Now, you may not call it doctrine, but you will believe something. And the same thing with cultural influence. Somebody will step in to make a difference. First Peter says to live such excellent lives among the pagans that the very thing they accuse you of doing wrong, because of your good deeds, they will glorify God. The question is, that's raised from that verse, is whether or not you're living among the pagans. Whether or not you actually have enough contact with the unsaved to actually have the question raised, to actually have your good deeds noticed. Now, the second question, of course, is that if you're living among the pagans, what's different about your life? But where have we, in today's society, abdicated our role? I would suggest a few. Education, maybe even higher education particularly. Organized labor. When you think of cultural Christian influence, do you think of the UAW? Do you think of the labor organizations in the world? Do you think that is that really where Christ and Christianity is vital and alive? Or have we abdicated that? How about medicine and science, science and technology, media, film, journalism, the print, the web, the video? Now, I'm not saying that these things are bad. I'm not saying that this is a place where have we decided intentionally and focused to have an influence. And the virtual world. I want to try to show you a new thing with virtual world. Mark has brought a little bit of this to my attention. But here's an area that is interesting for us to see whether or not, you know, what's going on here. I'm going to try to play this. I'm not sure I'm going to do this the right way. I'm not doing it the right way. Look at the people and look at the words. Notice something about this. This is a virtual world called Second Life, a place to connect. Place where you create another self, where you can shop, you can actually spend real money buying virtual clothes for your virtual self, you can have a virtual job, but you can also carry on live chat with the person who also has a virtual self, a place to love, where everybody drives Maseratis. Place to be different, place to be yourself. A place to change your look, a place to love your look, and a place to love your life. Second life. Do you want a second life? We are entering a place where reality for our culture is not satisfying enough. They want a different reality. Real reality isn't satisfying. So you can have a second life. You can, in a cultural sense, literally be born again. Virtually. What did you notice about all those people? Did you notice any old people? Did you notice anybody struggling with weight issues? Weren't they all trim? They are all athletic. They all seem to be at least upper middle class. I mean, I'm not sure what a Maserati costs, but I know I can't afford one. You know, there's all kinds of fun places. You can go on the Titanic. You can go to these clubs. You can go scuba diving. You can actually connect with other people through live chat who is putting themselves forward in a different persona, all done in a virtual world. Dr. Troy was telling me about someone who was commenting about how satisfying it was for them because they were able to buy gifts for their virtual person was able to buy virtual gifts for people in after Second Life, clothes for them for Christmas. They spent about $100 buying. And so there's a whole other career out there. If you want to be a fashion designer and can't make it for real, you can be a virtual fashion designer. And people can use their Linden dollars and buy with real money, buy fake clothes for fake people in the virtual world. I don't know. I'm not sure if you get a fake retirement when you're done. That would be difficult. But listen to what they're selling. A place to connect, shop, work, to love, explore, a place to be different, a place to be yourself, a place to free yourself, free your mind, change your look, love your looks, but even more importantly, a place to love your life. Now, not your real life, of course. This is your other life, because your real life isn't satisfying enough. So this is a chance to live, to love your second life, thus the name. Sent ones. In 2 Corinthians, where he said, Paul writes, "But thanks be to God who always leads us in triumph in Christ and manifests through us the sweet aroma of the knowledge of him in every place. For we are a fragrance of Christ to God." And that's what I want to talk about just for these last few moments. Paul is bringing up imagery of aroma and a fragrance. You'll probably remember that from some of your Old Testament classes where there was a burning of incense. But Paul is really talking about something different here. First of all, he's trying to conjure up that imagery because he's combating his credibility right now. People are wondering how credible his ministry is. And so what he's also trying to do is talk about, he's using the word aroma in a couple different ways. But one of the ways in which he's saying is, you know, my service to God is a sweet aroma to him. Romans 12:1 talks about in terms of being conformed to Christ, which is your reasonable service, your sacrificial service, and that will be an aroma to God. So he's trying to play off a little bit, saying, hey, my work is a sweet aroma to God, and that's all the credibility I need. But he's also using another metaphor. He's talking about being led in triumph, which is what victors did to the defeated foes. When a general back in the Roman army defeated an area, he took the generals, he put them in chains, and they led them in triumph through the city gates, and there was incense burning all along the way. And the defeated general would be led through the town. Of course, at the end of the parade, they were killed. But Paul is bringing up this imagery, talking about how he's being led in triumph. The ironic thing here is that Paul is the slave in this metaphor. Paul is the one saying, my identity is as a slave to Christ. And that service is a sweet aroma. That service brings a fragrance unto God. And the focus, though, in all this parade, though, is not on the slave and it's not on the incense. It's actually on the victor. It's actually on the general who conquered. So what I want to share with you some thoughts about is, what's the difference between going? Jesus commands us to go. Matthew says, go and make disciples. What's the difference between going and really being sent or a sent one? First of all, it requires a sender. If you're going to be sent, someone has to send you. That's obvious. The focus is not on the task or the sent one, but the focus is on the one doing the sending. Jesus said his food was to do the will of his Father. As the Father sends me, so send I you. The focus is not on where you're going or who's going, but back on the Father. Your mission is rooted in your identity, not the other way around. If your identity is rooted in your mission, whatever you've been called to do, then if what you're called to do is frustrating or not successful, or menial, or not in the spotlight, then your identity is diminished because it's rooted in your mission. It's the other way around. You get your identity straight, and the mission takes care of itself. Paul's identity was a slave to Christ, and his view of success was never attached to the success of his mission. It was always attached back to his identity. Being a sent one's identity is not based on the location and the nature or the success of the mission. It is based on faithfulness to the sender and obedience to the call. I want to give you four things. You know, the book of the Bible that talks about all the disciples going into the culture, only making a difference, is called the book of Acts, not the book of facts. There's a prejudice towards action at that point. So I want to give you, if I can use that acronym real quickly, to talk about four things I think you need, and this is where we'll kind of wrap up here in a little minute. I want to talk about the ACTS. If you can remember this acronym as you think about what's the difference between going and being a sent one. First of all, you need a proper orientation towards authority and a willing submission to it. Two primary sources of authority in your life is God as the sender. You need to have a proper orientation towards God. Paul's identity was as a slave to Christ. He often referred to himself as a bondservant. And when he was writing to people, he'd say as a fellow bondservant. He wanted to make sure their identity was right, because if their identity was right, then what they were called to do was really irrelevant. And it wouldn't matter if it was difficult, successful in the world's eyes or not. Get your identity straight. So what's your orientation? You need to have a proper orientation to authority. And another authority source is Scripture. Truth. You live in a culture that loves relevancy. What's true for you is true for you. It's not necessarily true for me. But as Christians, we believe there are some absolutes. There are some things that are really real and truly true. And we need to live our lives in a such a way that we portray to the world that Jesus is really real and the scriptures are really true. When our authority lies no higher than ourselves, this is Elton Trueblood, the Quaker philosopher, wrote, when our authority lies no higher than ourselves or only within ourselves, we tend to act less human. When it is higher than ourselves, outside of ourselves, we tend to act more humane. Where is your authority and what's your orientation to it? Second of all, community. A community of purpose and a community of mission. Commitment to Christ, this is community. Here's some things that need to make up this community. A commitment to Christ in common life and not separation from it. Many people are experiencing community in that second life and in that virtual world, but it's not the real deal. It's not real vulnerability. It's not real transparency. I can project myself. Are all the Facebook profiles accurate in the world? Are you really connecting with who you're really connecting with? People to people, face to face, living in a community that has a sense of commitment to Christ in the daily life and not in isolation from it. And then a sense of urgency and focus. What are you a part of? What kind of community are you a part of? A charge to keep, a focused mission in life. I want to read just real quickly the story of Esther Kim. She was taken prisoner during World War II, during the Korean War. It was during World War II and the Japanese occupation of Korea that Esther's journey of faith really began. I'm reading from Francis Chan's book, A Forgotten God. She refused to bow down at the shrines set up in every corner of her country, and was eventually imprisoned for 6 years, from 1939 until 1945. Knowing that she was destined for prison for refusing to bow down to idols, Esther spent time training herself both physically and spiritually. Every day she would find and eat food that was rotten and decaying because she knew that she would serve, that's the kind of food she'd be served while she was in prison. While preparing for prison, she memorized more than 100 chapters of the Bible and many hymns because she knew she would not be allowed to keep her Bible once she was in prison. She spent countless hours seeking God through fasting and prayer, and these times when she read the scriptures led to greater clarity, and she was able to surrender her fear of being tortured. My question to you is that many of you are thinking about going out and getting a secular job in a secular setting and going out to be a cultural influence. What are you training for? Are you training for that? Many of you will put more time and more energy and focus into what you're going to do and get ready for spring break. You know, make sure we have, you know, we get at least 6 hours of tanning in, and you get your passport if you're going to Cancun, and make sure your travel arrangements. There's more focus and there's more effort in terms of preparing for spring break than there is for the teaching profession that you're saying you're going to live and work in for the next 25 years. Are you studying the teaching profession? Are you studying journalism, the profession? Are you preparing to live and work and breathe in that culture? Esther didn't merely go to prison for her faith. She prepared for her mission and ministry in prison because of her faith. A community of purpose. And then a theology of witness. We've raised a generation, and I'm part of that generation. I grew up in a church where older people would stand up at the back of the church and grip the back of the pew and give a testimony. And as a child, I felt awkward about that. And then it kind of grows into a culture where we don't want to cast our virtue on people. We don't want to come across as though we're virtuous, more virtuous than we are. We don't want to impose our witness on somebody. And so out of respect for our privacy and your privacy, we've grown up a generation that is afraid to give a witness. The very thing that God called us to. You shall be my witnesses. And yet when we ask for testimonies or ask for witness, it's like somebody asks, you know, a most embarrassing question there is. If Jesus came back, he'd be astonished over the fact that, you know, it'd be like Apple's, the Apple company forgetting how to make computers, or Ford forgetting how to make cars. We've come back and we've forgotten how to give a witness. Jesus hung around prostitutes and tax collectors. The very people that we struggle communicating with are the very people that he flowed in communication with. He'd come back, he wouldn't recognize the body that he formed. We bear evidence in our life experience. We need to come back, and I want to wrap this up, a theology of involvement. If you'll notice the word witness, testimony, and involvement, they all have the word I in it, and that's not to be self-focused, but you do need to stand in the gap and realize that it's your experience. This is what I have learned. I have touched God. God has spoken to me. He touched me. And oh, the joy that floods my soul. Something happened, and now I know He touched me. The only answer for unfaith are people who are willing to stand up and share their personal witness, their personal testimony. And then a servant's identity. Cults do not convert on the basis of truth and argument so much as on the basis of fellowship and experience. And the number one factor in a survey of people who reflect that they've moved from being a nominal Christian to a committed Christian, the number one factor was a person. It wasn't a public experience. It wasn't a service. It wasn't a movie, as good as Blindside is. It wasn't that. It was a person who came alongside and served. We need to witness in both word and deed. St. Francis said that preach every day and if necessary, use words. We need to do it through our life, through our lips and through our life, through words and through actions. I use the metaphor, you get on a plane, which is the most important, the left wing or the right wing? Your life and your words, they both have to go together. The non-witnessing follower of Christ in both word and deed is a contradiction of terms. I've got so much more, but I'm going to stop and just tell the story, and then I'm going to dismiss. Will Willimon is, I think, still, the chaplain at Duke University, and he told this story when he was a kid. I want to go back to the standing in the gap and standing in the crossroads of culture, if you will. Because if you take one thing away today, what I want you to do is remember that you are sent by Christ, and you carry the scent of Christ with you. He told the story as a kid. He wanted to take this girl out for a date, but her mom and dad didn't believe in going to movies. So he waited for weeks and weeks until the sound of music came. And he thought, well, surely nobody would object to the sound of music. I mean, so he asked her, she said yes, and he went to pick up the girl at the house, met the daughter. They sat on the couch for a little while, and they got up to leave. And the father of the daughter got up, and he stood in the doorway. And the daughter's name was Susan. And he stood in the doorway and he said, Susan, don't go. Please don't go. If you walk out this door, you'll be turning your back on everything we've taught you to believe. Please don't go. And he stepped aside. And Will Willimon and Susan walked through the door and went out to see the sound of music. And Will Willimon tells the story. He said, thinking to myself the whole time, what a silly expression of faith to stand in front of us and say, don't go to the sound of music. But as he got older, he reflected back on that and he said, I don't know if it's worth standing in the doorway to stop people from going to see the sound of music or Avatar. But he says, I know this. As Christians, we need to be standing in the door a lot more often than we are. You have been called by God. You have been sent by Christ to be cultural influencers. Don't run for the hills and don't look like just like everybody else. Live such a qualitatively different life among the unsaved that they recognize it and they glorify your Father in heaven. Would you stand with me? Go, but don't just merely go. Go, but not just to your major or to your career, to your preferences. Go as one who is being sent with focus and with discipline and with mission and with purpose. Go with the knowledge that you are being sent by God and you carry within you the scent of Christ. Go.